You're listening to the podcast of Village Church in Burbank, California. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org. We hope you enjoy today's message.
Well, I want to ask you guys a question. I don't know if you've ever been asked this question before, but have you ever run away? Or have you ever known somebody to run away? You know, Disney has a really great story about this. You may have heard of this movie. It's called The Lion King. Does that sound familiar to anybody? No, not at all? Okay, well, let me give you a little recap then. Because the movie is just really spectacular in how it shows this aspect of what it means to live. There's a young lion, his name is Simba. He has an incredible relationship with his dad. And unfortunately, his dad passes away, and he believes that he's the reason for this passing. And he runs away. He goes off into the wilderness, he takes flight, and he tries to put all of that behind him like it never happened. He has all the adventures, he does all the things, until all of a sudden there's this wise monkey that comes up and likes to hit him on the head because he's always trying to get his attention. And through that experience, he chooses to go back and face what he has not faced before. He goes back and he chooses to face his pain. And that is something that is very profound and a moment that all of us at some point is going to struggle with. See, here's the reality. At some point, we all run away. We are good at running away, all of us. May not be physically as it was with the lion and the Lion King where we actually pack our bags and we take off. It may be emotionally. It may be in our thoughts. It may be mentally as well. But the reality is, at some point, we do take off. And this is where we're really struck and we're given a crossroads that we need to be able to deal with. Because in this moment, we're filled with this emotional turmoil, this inner conflict that we may or may not know how to navigate. And we're thinking, you know what, I took off and I went in a certain direction because I really believed I was right. I believed what I was thinking was true, and I was on the straight path. But in that crossroads, I'm now at a place where I have to determine, was my thinking true? Was it right? Am I actually going in the direction I need to be going in? And at that moment, we have a decision to make. But see, life is not defined by these moments. Life is defined by the choices we make in these moments. Luke chapter 15, Jesus is presented with a complaint, and then he gives three parables, three stories to help answer the question, or answer the complaint. The complaint is that he eats with sinners. The answer Jesus gives through these parables is, God pursues us, he does not chase us. Let's look a little bit deeper into that third parable this morning. Luke 15, 11. Then Jesus said, there was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the wealth that will belong to me. So he divided his assets between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all he had and traveled to a distant region. And there he squandered his wealth in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout that region, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens or wealthier people in that region, who sent him to the fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare, and here I am dying of hunger. I will get up and I'll go to my father and I'll say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands. So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far away off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion and ran to him and put his hands and arms around him and kissed him. Then he said to his father, I have sinned against heaven and before you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to the slaves, quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him, and a ring on his finger, and sandals on his feet. And get the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. Now the older son was in the field, and as he came in and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. He replied, your brother has come, and the father has killed the fatted calf, because he has gotten him back safe and sound. Then he became angry, and he refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him. But he answered the father, listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command, yet you have never given me as much as a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when his son of yours comes back, who has devoured your assets with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him. Then the father stated to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and has come back to life. He was lost and he has been found. There's a few things in that passage I want to highlight. It's interesting to me that when the younger brother decided to come back, he came back out of his physical need. He didn't come back because he recognized at that moment his rebelliousness. He didn't recognize his heart at that moment. He came back because he was hungry. He came back because he was literally starving. And so the fact that he had this physical need drove him. That was the crossroads he was at. It drove him to make a decision that he may not have made otherwise. It's also interesting to me as we read that the older brother's interpretation of what the younger brother did with his living, with the wealth, was different than what Scripture said. Scripture said that he devoured his assets. He gave it away. And in some of the material that I was reading, it talked about how that may not have been moral failure. It may have been, it may not, we really don't know. But the brother, older brother's interpretation of that was that he not only got rid of his assets, but he devoured it with prostitutes, which is a very clear picture of what he believes is happening in that moment. See, here's the reality. In essence, this is a family in chaos. This is a family that is filled with anxiety. This is a family that is filled with dysfunction. This is a family that is not connected or even put together. I often wondered, though, as I'm reading this, where is the mom in this story? Like, we kind of think mom's an important piece to the puzzle when it comes to families, right? Like, she's usually somewhere, whether she's in the next room, she's caring for the children, but Scripture doesn't actually give us any indication as to where mom is at in this specific family. Some of the theologians that I read and I looked into even asked the question, I wonder where mom is, but none of them really gave a good explanation or answer as to where they thought her presence was. So, you know, it's kind of speculation on my part, but I kind of wonder if this is part of the pain both of these lost sons was experiencing, because they are both lost. And that is something we truly know. They are both in a lot of pain. Both of them are lost. Both of them do not see the heart of their father. They don't see his character. And by the end, both of them are pursued by their father in the exact way that they need. When we look a little bit closer, we can see a little bit more about the different dynamics that is happening in this family. The younger brother is obviously not in a good place with his father. He went out and he just, in such a disrespectful and disdained manner, asked him for his share of the inheritance, which is basically telling the dad, I wish you weren't even here. I'd wish you had died. In this village, it was very widely known that it would have been the older brother's responsibility to create a reconciliation between the father and the younger brother, and yet he didn't do that. The silence of the older brother is felt wide and far, and it's deep. The chasm of anger and hurt and bitterness is extreme between the two brothers. And the relationship between the father and the older brother is just as broken and just as lost as it is with the younger brother. At the core, rejection between the older father and the younger and the father is the same. The only difference is that the younger brother at some point recognizes rebelliousness, and the older brother stays hidden behind what was right and what he believed was true, the law. Kenneth Bailey, in his book, The Cross and the Prodigal, commented that both of the sons rejected the father in a very similar way. One wasn't better, one wasn't worse. It was still rejection, and they still ultimately did the same thing. They both broke their father's heart. They both ran away. Neither of them truly knew their father. They didn't know his heart. They did not know his character. Their focus was elsewhere. Oftentimes in practice, as most of you know, that I'm a pastoral counselor, I'm also a therapist, so oftentimes in practice with my clients, we talk about a principle, and I tell them that whatever we focus on gets bigger. That's the principle. Whatever we focus on gets bigger. It's like a horse with blinders. All I can see is literally what is right in front of me. I can't see anywhere else or anything else. And because that's all I can see, that's all I'm focused on, then that's all I can react to. So here's the reality, though. As humans, we are driven towards two universal truths. The first one is that we gravitate towards negativity. And the second is we strive to be known, to be loved, and to belong. And so if whatever I focus on gets bigger and all I'm gravitating towards a negative, then the negative is what's going to get bigger for me because it's what is right in front of me. But deep inside all of us, we have this yearning to be known and to belong and to be loved. And this is why God pursues us and does not chase us. He graciously gives us the freedom to chart our own path in life. See, that's the critical difference between pursuing and chasing. When we choose someone relationally, we are doing that to fill our own needs, our own desires. We do this and often say it's because we love that person. The reality is we chase connection for ourselves. Pursuing someone occurs as we allow them to be who they are. No controlling, no manipulating. We surrender to the fact that they have the freedom to reject us. Rejection is a core issue, and we all wrestle with it if we have not been wrestling with it already. We live out of fear of rejection. We will chase the ones we love. And often when this happens, we sabotage that relationship because we end up chasing them away. We can sometimes blame this on so many other things. It actually has nothing to do with the reality of the situation that we're in. The failed relationship happened because I acted out of fear of that rejection. I held on too tight. If God chased us, Samuel and Saul would not have fallen. Chasing seeks to rescue others from their pain. Why? Because I'm so fearful of the rejection that may come when somebody walks through pain. I want to prevent that from happening. What we focus on gets bigger, even in our fear of rejection. Chasing is striving to be connected in a negative way. It takes away the identity and the uniqueness of the person I say I love. The flip side of this coin is pursuing. When we pursue somebody, we love them, we want them in that relationship. We want them to know also that I'm secure and that we can have a healthy dependency. I need you, you need me. It's reciprocal, but I can also be without you in that relationship. And as a result, there's a level of kindness and patience that comes. This kind of love doesn't envy. It doesn't boast. It isn't rude. It's not prideful. It simply just shows up in this relationship. It surrenders and separates out what we may need, what I may need, from what they may need. Recognizing that my needs and their needs are often going to be different, and that is okay. This feels and looks very differently. And in fact, one of the most best compliments I've ever received in a relationship is when I had hurt a friend and I went to them and I said, I am so sorry that I hurt you. And they said, oh, Kim, all is forgiven. I know your heart. Ah, that there's just a peace and a sigh that comes over us, like from the top to the bottom in that moment, when somebody can see our heart and know that there was no intentionality there, that this was just human mistake that happened. And because of that, when I see them and they see me, there's a joy that's expressed on our face in the connection of the mutuality that comes, the reciprocal nature that comes in that relationship. Beautiful reciprocal pursuit. We are mutually pursuing and wanting good for the other. That is what it looks like in our human relationships. But here's where we take a shift in the pursuing. God's pursuit is different. Like the father in the parable, God's love is lavish and radical. His pursuit is unabashed and it is not reciprocal. Living in a small community, the whole village knew this family. Culturally, they knew that if the younger brother was to ever return, he would have been cut off. In fact, the day he asked for an inheritance, in all intents and purposes, the entire village knew that guy is cut off and we'll never see him again. In this strong patriarchal society, the younger son had not only burned all his bridges, it's as if he had never wanted to make any connection at all with anybody. Life was being lived out on his terms, in his own way, as he had wanted it. He wanted out. And the village probably even commended the older brother for doing the right thing, sticking to the law, making sure he was obedient. And so even in the brother's lostness, the older brother's lostness, he was probably affirmed by others that he was culturally doing what was right because that's what they knew. And this is where the father's character, his heart, this radical love for his sons, and please don't miss this. Jesus does not, I think, want us to miss this as he talks about this parable. He's showing us the heart of God. Because he knows that our nature is to focus on the negative and that we need to be wanted, we need to belong, and we need to be loved. In the middle of the storm, the father waited patiently. He knew both of his sons were lost and waited for the moment to speak life into them. Basically, the father gave both of his sons the freedom to reject him. And reject him, they both did. The father's love is so radical, no reciprocity was needed. Because of how the father responded to his sons, especially his younger son's request, he set the stage for reconciliation that may not have ever come. Because he waited for them to experience life on their terms, he planted seeds for what could be in the future. Because he pursued them, and he did not chase them, he gave space for healing that may not have been there beforehand. Culturally, he was intentionally choosing to befuddle everybody. And make no mistake, everybody in the entire village was watching this father and waiting to see what happened. Luke 15:20 says, "So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and he kissed him." Let's go back to that 15:20. I want to make a mention here because I think this is really interesting what happens here. So the father was waiting. We've already established that. And as he was waiting, he saw his son coming. He had to have been waiting to see his son coming. So he saw him, and he did something very interesting. At the moment he had a visual of his son, he was filled with compassion. And then a few things happened as a result. He ran, he threw his arms around him, and he kissed him. He waited for this exact moment, the father did. You know the times in life where we believe that God is distant in silence, and that maybe he's even abandoned us? What if, in fact, That's not what's happening. What if, in fact, maybe God is waiting for us? What if instead of us being in our pain and our thoughts about him being silent because we're in pain and he's not connected or understanding that pain, what if he sees our pain? What if he sees exactly what we're going through in that moment and he's waiting for us? God oftentimes actually gets a very bad rap in the book of Job because there's a large part of that book where we don't hear from God. But what if God wasn't silent or uncaring or disconnected from Job in that moment? What if he was actually waiting in that moment? The radical, unorthodox love of God is clearly represented in the Father in this parable. The Father's compassion compelled him to physically pick up the hem of his robes and run towards his son, which was not the custom of the day. He does not wait to be approached, as would have been the expectation. He waited for his son to turn towards him and throw off any inhibition and welcomed him home with open arms and kissed him again and again and again with deep compassion. And when I looked up that part of scripture, that's how it translated. He saw him with deep compassion. He kissed him over and over. He just could not get enough. You know what that's like when you have someone you truly love and you just can't let go of them? And you just want to hang on and cling to that over and over, that deep, deep, compassionate love. This is the Father's experience with his son in that moment. There was no humiliation, no guilt, no shame. For the Father, it was like that bridge had never been burned. I imagine for a second that, you know, as that son, how weird that may have felt. Because he had a script all laid out in his mind of what this was going to look like and how he was going to move forward in that way. He knew this is what's going to happen. There, I know I've been cut off. I'm going to approach my father. I'm going to ask for this. I'm going to ask for that. And I'm going to be able to move in and to be a hired hand. In fact, I'm not even going to expect to still be in the role of a son. And yet here his father comes, and I imagine he kind of like stood in shock as he's seen his father running down the road towards him with arms open wide. He probably had no idea how to even respond or react. So such love. Scripture really doesn't give us an indication of the son's reaction in that moment, but at the same time, we can imagine from our own experience what that may have been like. So now we move a little bit forward in the story, and we know that the older son is coming out of the fields, and he is experiencing this party that's happening at the big house. The emotion that has been just under the surface for the older son starts to bubble up. Luke 15, 28 and 29 says, "Then he became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him. But he answered his father, 'Listen, for all these years, I have been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you have never given me so much as a young goat to celebrate with my friends.'" So the older brother knows this is happening. He knows something's happening. He's having this conversation with the father. He refuses to come in. Again, for the second time in a day, the father shows up in a way we don't expect. For the second time in the same day, the father pursues his other son. But not the way he did the first one. He pursued the second one in the way he needed to be pursued. And I find it quite fascinating that God will do that with you and me. Because here's the reality. This is the heart of God. This is his character. He freely gave you and I both the opportunity to run away. He gave us the opportunity to reject him. God is pursuing us. He is not chasing us. In Philippians, Paul says that the Lord is ever faithful to complete the good work in us to the very end. The story doesn't have a nice, clean ending. It doesn't wrap up in a nice, pretty bow. Because as we said, there's no indication of actually how either one of the sons truly did respond to the father's heart. We all hope and desire for a happy ending, but that would be antithetical to the pursuit of the father. The response has nothing to do with his pursuit, and neither does it when God pursues you and when he pursues me. We know that when God pursues us with this radical, unorthodox love, he's giving us two choices. The first one, I can turn towards him, seek forgiveness, reconciliation, and repair that relationship. The second one, I have the freedom to turn away, to reject him, and to continue to live in my suffering. Henry Nouwen, in his book, The Return of the Prodigal Son, stated that when he was his closest to despair, he pondered on whether he had sufficiently realized that God was trying to find him, to know him, to love him. He goes on and says, the question is not, how am I to find God, but how am I to let myself be found by him? The question is not, how am I to know God, but how am I to let myself be known by God? And finally, the question is not, how am I to love God, but how am I to let myself be loved by God? God is looking into the distance, trying to find me and longing to bring me home. God pursues each of us. He doesn't chase us. This love has long lived before rejection and will long live way after rejection. As we close today, I want to invite you to think about two different questions. The first one, can I accept that I am worthy of this kind of deep love? Can I accept that I am so loved by God that God will ardently pursue me throughout my entire life? As you think about these questions, we're going to move into a short video. The song is called Faithfully by a musician named Toby Mac. You may have heard of him. What you may or may not know about him is that several years ago, his oldest son died of an overdose here in Los Angeles, and as a result came this album, Life After Death. I want you to listen to how God pursues him as he shares his heart through this song.
Thank you for listening to today's message. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org.